You're listening to the Labor Express. Your call is only English language labor news and current affairs radio program. News for working people by working people. I'm your host, Jeremy Lucero, and this is the Sunday, October 5th, 2008 edition of Labor Express. On tonight's program, we'll continue our focus on the financial crisis and the $700 billion bailout that was passed into law on Friday. We'll hear from the Economic Policy Institute Vice President Ross Eisenbray. EPI is one of the country's leading progressive economic think tanks, and we'll get their analysis of the bailout and what it means for working class Americans. We'll also hear some audio from Jobs for Justice rally that was held outside the Federal Reserve Bank in downtown Chicago on Wednesday. But of course, first we have this week's labor news highlights from WIN, Workers Independent News.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham.
And I'm Jesse Russell. The Center for Economic and Policy Research says the U.S. financial crisis is a policy failure of massive proportions. Doug Cunningham has more.
Economist Dean Baker says the central economic problem is the collapsing housing market, but he says that former Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan and other economic policymakers had the tools to rein in the housing bubble before it reached this crisis stage. The Case-Shiller 20-city index shows a housing price drop of nearly 20% in 2 years. That came, though, after home prices adjusted for inflation jumped by more than 70% between 1996 and 2006. The price decline of the past 2 years has triggered unprecedented rates of mortgage defaults and failures of financial instruments based on these bad mortgages. And the worst of that wave isn't over. The sheer magnitude of these defaults and the fact that mortgage debt has been packaged into derivatives throughout the financial sector has led to the insolvency of banks and other financial institutions. Baker says the path out of this disaster isn't going to be easy, but he says one vital lesson in it is that future speculative bubbles that depart so dramatically from past sound financial practices must be stopped before they grow so large as to threaten the entire financial system.
Roughly 8,100 Hanes brand employees could be impacted following an announcement last week that the company would be closing 9 North American plants. The underwear maker, which includes Hanes, Playtex, and Wonder Bra, plans to eliminate 16% of its North American workforce as it moves those jobs to Asia. The move will nearly end the company's production relationship with the United States as it closes 2 of its last remaining plants in this country, as well as an inventory storage warehouse. Other countries being impacted by the closures are Mexico, Costa Rica, Honduras, and El Salvador. The company plans to add 6,000 jobs in Asia by the end of the year.
The stock market closed Monday hundreds of points down on the news that the U.S. House failed to pass a $700 billion financial system bailout package. The economic catastrophe caused by unregulated free market irresponsibility threatens millions of working people, as well as the entire U.S. financial system. Economist Josh Bivens at the Economic Policy Institute believes a bailout is needed, but it should be targeted to cushion the economic blow to working people.
Even a well-designed bailout is not a silver bullet that makes everything fine, but essentially it will transform what could be a real economic disaster back into just sort of the garden variety recession that we're in right now.
Ed Ott is executive director of the New York City Central Labor Council. He wants to see direct aid to the millions of people at risk of losing their homes.
Money in there so that people can refinance where it's necessary. We'd like to see them use the force of the law to suspend all foreclosures.
The AFL-CIO says the House bailout package fell far short of what working people need because there's too little relief for homeowners. The Labor Federation says it understands the very serious risks to working families of a financial collapse and believes there's need for a comprehensive government package to prevent it. But the AFL-CIO says it had serious doubts about the bailout package that was defeated in the U.S. House on Monday. Concerns over a turbulent economy left striking waste management workers in Milwaukee with few options during a third contract vote on Sunday. Jesse Russell reports.
The strike against waste management in the Milwaukee region of Wisconsin started more than a month ago. The 240 drivers and mechanics represented by the Teamsters approved the contract on Sunday by a 2-to-1 margin. In a statement, the Teamsters wrote, "The continued financial and personal strain took its toll on our members. With this vote, our members decided that given the turbulent nature of our economy, their family's future must take priority over holding out for a better offer from waste management. The 5-year contract cuts back on wages and health care benefits and establishes a new 401k program for the workers. Workers will return to work on Wednesday."
Sony Ericsson is cutting 450 U.S. jobs due to dropping demand for high-end phones worldwide. It's part of a plan to cut 2,000 jobs worldwide by the end of the year. The AFL-CIO is launching a new campaign reaching out to over a million union swing voters on the health care issue. The effort is targeted in battleground states, including Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Michigan. It centers on John McCain's proposal to tax employer-based health care benefits and essentially privatize Medicare. The AFL-CIO calls it a risky health care scheme that just further burdens already economically struggling workers and middle-class families. A mass mailing, a million leaflets, more than 150,000 phone calls, and home visits in Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Ohio are all part of this campaign. The AFL-CIO is in the midst of its largest campaign mobilization in history, contacting over 13 million voters in 24 priority states. Machinists at Boeing remain steadfast on the picket lines. According to Businessweek magazine, the strike is costing Boeing more than it would have cost to meet the union's pension demands. IAM's Tom Robleski.
Our members are committed. They tell me that they are here to do whatever it takes to win this battle against the Boeing company.
Nearly 700 communities across the country participated in a national Green Jobs Now event. Jesse Russell reports on one of them that took place in the Bronx.
Tanya Fields is the outreach coordinator for Sustainable South Bronx, which hosted a Green Jobs Now event in the New York City borough this weekend. She explained what the event was all about.
We are ready for the investment in green jobs, that green jobs can really be used as a pathway out of poverty.
Fields said green jobs are important not only for the environment, but also for creating better paying jobs in areas stricken by poverty.
Green jobs have really been a very effective way of not only remedying a lot of the environmental issues that are happening, but simultaneously creating living wage jobs for the people in those communities.
Carlos Angel is a member of Rebuilder Source, and he attended the event in the Bronx. Rebuilder Source is a worker-owned cooperative that salvages reusable construction materials and supplies. He says people need to develop a green conscience.
We had to try to make a change because we're still in time to save our Mother Earth. And if we start from now by throwing away our plastics, or recycling our papers, metals, not wasting water, you know, it's a beginning. And from there on, you can start developing a green conscience.
A federal court has dismissed a $30 million lawsuit against the United Brotherhood of Carpenters. The union was sued over a campaign it conducted at a new residential housing development. Ogler Homes Incorporated had sued, claiming hand-billing, picketing, and bannering by the union prevented sale of homes in that development and went beyond what's allowed by law. But Judge Frederick J. Capilla disagreed and threw out the lawsuit. The Carpenters Union says it's a victory for the right of free speech. Terrence McCann, an attorney for the Carpenters, says this is a great victory not just for the Carpenters Union, but for all of the building and construction trades. It took 2 years of litigation for the Carpenters to win this case. The AFL-CIO's Building and Construction Trades Department is out with a new video on John McCain's positions in his own words. The Labor Federation notes that McCain is no friend of construction workers, having tried to undermine the Davis-Bacon prevailing wage law and voting to allow contractors to hire permanent strike-breaking workers in labor disputes. McCain also voted against two highway bills that would have provided 5 million jobs over 6 years, according to the AFL-CIO. Many universities are providing ways for union members to earn college degrees as they transition from building trades to the next phase. Jesse Russell reports.
With the future of the economy uncertain, many union workers are finding themselves looking for ways to enhance or add new skills. Some universities around the country provide specialized programs that work with labor unions to assist members in transitions to new careers or to earn new required certifications. The City University of New York has such a program. Deborah D'Amico is with the school's Murphy Center.
The range of workers and union members who are interested in and feel it necessary to get a degree, I mean, building trade union members who are making good salaries, sort of are seeing the handwriting on the wall, like how many years can I do hard physical labor and what's going to be there for me afterwards.
She said such programs help provide a way for workers to ease into the college world.
What we're trying to do with unions is build on the fine training and education that unions are providing and building pathways into college, which for many union workers is the next step and is a necessary one.
Here is today's economic report. Manufacturing plunged during the month of September. According to the monthly report from the Institute of Supply Management, the manufacturing index fell to 43.5% last month. That's the lowest level since October 2001. It is also the biggest drop in 24 years. The same report also found that rising prices slowed to their lowest level in 21 months.
Wynn's Labor News is now available right on your cell phone. Just dial 425-527-7001. Get your Wynn Labor News on your cell phone at 425-527-7001.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to Wynn, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And you're listening to Labor Express Radio, news for working people by working people. And that was this week's Labor News Highs from Wynn, Workers Independent News. I want to thank Wynn for allowing us to broadcast their material, and I want to encourage our listeners to check out the Wynn website at www.laborradio.org. You can also find a link to the Wynn website on our website, which is www.laborexpress.org. I do want to say real quick, too, the way that we put the Wynn segment together here for Labor Express is that we compile parts of their daily news broadcast that Wynn has throughout the week into a kind of end-of-the-week wrap-up here. And since their last piece that they would have issued would have been on Friday morning, obviously they weren't aware yet of the bailout that was passed on Friday afternoon. So what you heard there was references to the first round of the bailout that was that did not pass earlier in the week. They didn't have any reference to the second round that did pass on Friday afternoon after they made their last broadcast for the week. You also may have heard there throughout the broadcast they referred to EPI, the Economic Policy Institute. We're going to be hearing from the vice president of the EPI later on in this program about the economic crisis. Wynn's often relies on them as well for their economic analysis. Well, on last week's program, I aired for you an interview that I conducted with Fran Tobin, the Midwest field organizer of Jobs with Justice. In that interview, we discussed Jobs with Justice's position that what we need is not a Wall Street bailout, but a comprehensive economic recovery plan. Of course, the greatest anti-poverty program ever devised is union membership. You know, whatever benefits, rights, et cetera, workers still hold on to today that they that their predecessors back in the 19th and early 20th centuries did not enjoy, whatever is left. I mean, we've had so much taken away now in the last 25, 30 years, but whatever we do have left, those things were won by the labor movement through years of struggle, and they exist only because of the efforts of organized labor. So as Fran and I discussed what would be included in this economic recovery plan that they're proposing, the issue of the Employee Free Choice Act, or the EFCA, was raised. The EFCA is a landmark labor law reform proposal that would finally establish more balance in our legal system for workers who are combating this unlimited power of corporations when they try to organize. You know, labor law in this country is completely dysfunctional at this point. It's pretty much, you know, the right to organize is pretty much in name only in the workplace of today. And the EFCA would restore some protections for workers who want to join a union. On last week's program, we ran out of time to air Fran's comments on the EFCA, so I want to air those comments here for you now. You brought up the Employee Free Choice Act earlier, too, and I thought maybe we could take a minute or two just to say talk about that as well, because that is very relevant to what's going on here as well, which is, you know, if we're really going to have a fundamental change in our economy, it's going to require the ability of workers to organize. And as we know, labor law is completely broken in this country, and it's really not a practical right that workers have in this country right now. So can you talk, remind our listeners again what the Employee Free Choice Act is about and where that's at right now?
The basic push of the Employee Free Choice Act, which passed the House last year and was filibustered by the Republicans in the Senate, is to make it easier. It's really simple. It's to make it easier for workers to unionize. And then as a group, as a union, they can have a voice on the job and have more of a say-so and have a little more leverage and the ability to bargain over conditions in the workplace. It's pushed because, as you said, I mean, labor law is broken. We have a system that's supposed to facilitate people getting organized. The right to organize, whether it's on the street or in the workplace, is fundamental to all democracy. So right now that's been thwarted, and it's been documented that in about 1 out of 5 times that people try to organize, that someone gets fired, even though that's illegal. And the list of ways that companies use illegal union busting tactics is very long. So the Employee Free Choice Act creates penalties so that if an employer uses various illegal tactics to prevent the workers from forming a union, that there's actually a process and actual penalties. Now, they're supposed to be there already, but they're just unenforceable and it's kind of meaningless. So this creates some real penalties, which frees the workers from the kind of pressure that comes from the boss around organizing. The other thing it does is it says that if you can't come to an agreement within a certain period of time as to what that contract would should be, then there would be an arbitration and mediation process. So that allows, that prevents employers, prevents the companies, the bosses, from just dragging their feet forever. Right now, they can just never agree to anything. And even though that technically is illegal, they can find ways, and there are consultants who get paid a lot of money to help them find ways to just get around the law. So they never have to actually agree to a contract. So even though there should be some kind of agreement, they just refuse. The third thing is it allows people that once a majority of the workers have signed up, then it says that, okay, you have a union, and so you need to negotiate with the workers.
Well, Fran, thanks for taking out time to talk with me. And we're definitely going to be talking more about the Employee Free Choice Act on upcoming episodes of Labor Express. Yeah, we will definitely be talking about the FCA, the Employee Free Choice Act, more because it's an extremely important piece of legislation that is kind of just languishing right now in the Congress. Certainly after the elections in November, there's hope that there may be some headway made on that. So we'll definitely be talking about that more on upcoming episodes of Labor Express. You're listening to Labor Express, Chicago's only English language labor news and current affairs radio program. And in my interview with Fran Tobin of Jobs with Justice last week, Fran told us that JWJ will be holding organizing actions around the country on Wednesday to demand that Congress pass a comprehensive economic recovery plan rather than a Wall Street bailout. The action here in Chicago consisted of a rally outside the Federal Reserve Bank in downtown Chicago. It was a smallish rally, about 30 or 40 people in attendance, which is really actually not that bad for an action that was planned or announced only a day and a half previous. By far the largest contingent at the rally were members of the NNOC, that's the National Nurses Organizing Committee. They were in town for a conference, and they were there in numbers on Wednesday. The nurses were particularly angry about the fact that they've been arguing with politicians for years. You know, the politicians have been telling them that a national health care program that they're in favor of is too expensive, that that we can't afford that. Now, these same politicians, of course, are coming back and asking us to accept a $700 billion bailout plan for Wall Street. So the nurses were fairly fired up that day at the rally outside the Federal Reserve Bank. The MC for the rally was Executive Director of Chicago Jobs with Justice, James Thinwa, who spoke directly to the nurses' concerns.
If a Wall Street crisis necessitates government action, a health care crisis involving 49 million Americans with no health insurance necessitates government action. We can't say, oh, there's a crisis on Wall Street, government is the answer. But when millions go without health insurance, we're constantly told there is no money, government is not the answer. Well, we cannot bail out Wall Street without bailing out patients and people who need health insurance. Bail out health care, that's right. There is anger, not just in Chicago. There is anger everywhere today across the United States. People are saying, where are our priorities? Where are the priorities when bridges are collapsing in Minnesota? When children are growing hungry? When millions of families are facing foreclosure and are becoming homeless? Where are the priorities that allow our federal government to very quickly find billions of dollars, $750 billion to be exact, to rescue individuals who are making out like bandits in this economy? It's not just the exorbitant CEO salaries. It's the fact that this is the same class of people that just 2 years ago, in the last 3 years, got two tax cuts, even as we spent $12 billion a month in Iraq. These rich people got two tax cuts, and now they're asking us to bail us out.
This very same banks went to Washington 2 years ago, as you know, and said consumers are abusing bankruptcy laws. And everybody knows here, especially the nurses know, that healthcare is the number one cause of bankruptcy. People don't just walk into the courtroom because they want to abuse bankruptcy laws. They are doing it because healthcare costs are forcing them into bankruptcy. This very same banks went to Washington and demanded that Congress close the door to bankruptcy protection. And now here they are in a state of crisis. What do they want? They want protection. They want bailout. So here's what we are demanding. We are demanding first that as a condition for any action that Congress takes, that there is an initiative to create jobs, a job stimulus package that involves massive investments in infrastructure. That way we stimulate the economy and create jobs. We think that there ought to be a freeze on foreclosures. The people who are forcing millions of people to go without homes cannot be bailed out without us first taking care of people who are facing foreclosure. We want to ensure that healthcare is resolved in this country. As I said, we cannot have millions of people go without health insurance and spend billions of dollars rescuing bankers. So, before we start, yes, healthcare first, healthcare first, healthcare first. Healthcare first! Healthcare first! Healthcare first!
You're listening to Labor Express Radio, news for working people by working people, and that was James Thinwall, Executive Director of Jobs with Justice, talking at the Jobs with Justice organized rally outside the Federal Reserve Bank on Wednesday. And as you could hear there, the nurses were frequently interrupting. They were so fired up on Wednesday and so angry about the idea of a bailout plan when they've been asking for a national health care plan for so many years. Probably the most powerful speaker at the rally on Wednesday was Reverend Gregory Livingston, who's with the Rainbow Push Coalition.
Don't sell out for the bailout. Say it with me. Don't sell out for the bailout. Don't sell out for the bailout. Don't sell out for the bailout. Let me tell you why. Let me tell you why, everybody. I'm Reverend Gregory Livingston, Rainbow Push Coalition. Reverend Jackson right now is at our automotive conference in Detroit, but we're here 100% behind this. Reverend Jackson has been meeting with Bernanke and Paulson and all these people, because the thing is, brothers and sisters, is that Wall Street cannot stand without Main Street. The wall will fall without Main Street. And the business of Wall Street is Main Street. Can I get an amen, somebody?
Amen.
Look at this. Over the past 40 weeks, over the past 10 months, 400,000 Americans a week for the past 40 weeks have applied for unemployment insurance. I have to say that again. Over the past 40 weeks, 10 months, 400,000 Americans per week over the last 10 months have applied for unemployment insurance. And guess what? If you have that many Americans applying for unemployment insurance, tell me how then, without a job, they're going to pay their mortgages. If 400,000 Americans a week are applying for unemployment insurance, how then are they going to pay their mortgages? Just last week in Cook County, we had 800 houses up for auction. Just last week. Just last week in Cook County, 700 more houses were sold back to the banks. 700 more houses. That's 1,500 families. What happens to these families? Do they get a golden parachute? Do they get severance pay? Is somebody taking care of them? The answer is no. You see, brothers and sisters, I don't care what's happening up in the Capitol, on Main Street, there's still unfinished business. Can you say that? Unfinished business. The business of Main Street is unfinished. When you have 400,000 Americans per week applying for unemployment insurance, when you have over 1,000 houses going up for auction in Cook County, the business of Main Street is unfinished. Now, here's what we are demanding, here's what we're wanting. You must have a plan that will take care of those that are being foreclosed upon, those that are losing their homes. If that doesn't happen, there won't be a street for Wall Street to stand on. Come on, everybody, can you hear your scream? The other thing that we're demanding is this. We're not giving Wall Street anything. There can't be any grants to Wall Street. There can't be any giveaways to Wall Street. The average taxpayer should not be subsidizing investment bankers. The average taxpayer should not be subsidizing European vacation homes. The average taxpayer should not be subsidizing luxury cars. The average taxpayer should be able to put a roof over their family's head, be able to send their child to college, be able to afford health care. That is what our money should be used for. And we will hoodwink, bamboozle, run amok, and trick when folk were given these exotic derivative mortgage deals. And now look what's happening. The chickens have come home to roost. The very folk that were making the money are jumping out of windows with golden parachutes, and we're saying no more. Because when you jump off the wall, you got to hit Main Street. Am I right about it, everybody? So this is what needs to happen. We have voted people in office to represent us in D.C. Now, before they make any deals, they need to come back to their various areas, congressmen, senators, whoever they might be, and hold town hall meetings with the public, town hall meetings with their constituents, and say, here is the document that we're being asked to vote on. We need our people to come together, people that have been foreclosed on, people that are being put out of their jobs, people that are losing their life savings, people that are losing their lives because of no health care. And so we're going to sit down and we're going to talk about this document and see not if the document is good for Wall Street, but if it's good for Main Street. Again, brothers and sisters, the business of Main Street is unfinished. We will not stop marching. We will not stop demonstrating. We will not stop protesting until the business of Wall Street becomes the business of the White House, the business of the Capitol, the business of your congressman, the business of your senator, and the business of your presidential candidates. It must be Main Street before Wall Street, or we'll all be up and down the street with nothing in America. Thank you so much, and God bless you.
You're listening to Labor Express, your call's only English language labor news and current affairs radio program. And I'm sure all of you out there are already aware of the fact that the $700 billion bailout package, version 2 at least, did pass in the Congress on Friday and was quickly signed into law that afternoon by President Bush. There were some significant and important changes from the original Bush-Paulson proposal, but this certainly wasn't the economic recovery or economic reconstruction plan that many progressives and many in the labor movement were calling for. Nonetheless, many progressive-minded labor economists believe strongly that some sort of infusion of cash into the credit markets quickly was an absolute essential necessity to stave off an even worse economic crisis than the one that we're currently in. They argue that the deep economic recession is basically inevitable at this point, that if we had no bailout, that the credit markets could have seized up completely and that could have had a catastrophic outcome for the entire economy. That's, of course, the terrible catch-22 of the situation. The economic elites that have created this crisis, have created this mess, have created such a mess that if we don't pass a bailout plan, that's going to be borne, of course, on the backs of the working class, that it could lead to an economic collapse, which, of course, would hurt the working class even further. So, as usual, the elite will get off relatively unscathed, in this case, bailout plan or none, but it's us workers, again, who are presented with a bad situation and an even worse situation. One of the organizations that I believe was behind a strongly modified bailout plan was the Economic Policy Institute, or EPI. The EPI is a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank that seeks to broaden the public debate about strategies to achieve a prosperous and fair economy. Since their founding in 1986, they've been one of the major sources of counsel and advice on economic matters for the labor movement, and their research has been key in developing legislative proposals to make our economy more worker-friendly to the extent that that is possible. I talked with Vice President of EPI Ross Eisenbray on Saturday by phone to get EPI's analysis of the bailout bill that passed on Friday and to find out what they think will be the impact of this measure on working people in the United States. I started our conversation by asking Ross to tell me a little more about the work of EPI.
We're a research institute in Washington, D.C. We're nonpartisan. We have focused for about 20 years on the labor market, on the wages, hours, working conditions, benefits of working Americans. And in the last few years, we've started spending more of our time and effort on developing policies to change the economic fortunes of working Americans.
And I've frequently gone to your website to read your analysis of various things going on in the economy. And certainly I turned to your website in this current financial crisis as I was trying to kind of make heads or tails about what was going on and what this bailout plan meant and so on. Can you give us a little bit of details about the bailout bill that passed in the Congress on Friday? I guess it was also signed into law by the President on Friday as well. What was in that? How did it differ from that original Paulson plan that we heard about last week?
Well, the original Paulson plan was essentially the Secretary of the Treasury asking for $700 billion and the authority to use it to buy up assets of damaged financial institutions and even toxic assets of any institution, whether it was a failing institution or not, with no strings attached. And in fact, with language that said there could be no judicial review of his actions. So it literally meant that the Secretary of the Treasury could take $700 billion and spend it to, you know, if he were totally corrupt, he could have bought yachts for his family, and there could be no review by Congress, any agency, or the courts. So the initial idea was just simply a blank check, and it was outrageous. And but it was enough to at least start the conversation on Capitol Hill, which moved very quickly into something that still gives the Secretary of Treasury enormous authority to dispense of $700 billion, but does have limitations and gives directions to him about what he should do with it. So, for example, instead of just directing him, giving him the authority to buy up assets that are not worth very much right now, it gives him the authority, if he chooses to use it, to actually buy shares in companies, which is a much better approach to actually buy stock in the companies that have these toxic assets, and that thereby giving the taxpayer a chance to benefit on the upside when companies are recapitalized, they get this infusion of cash from the government, they start lending money again, and they do better, and they begin to make a profit, then the government's stock that it's bought would increase in share value, and the government could then sell it and make the money back. That was a very important addition that Congress made. There are small changes that are more symbolic than anything in limiting executive compensation. Almost everybody, is made sick by the thought that the companies that engaged in the riskiest behavior and the worst practices sometimes reward their CEOs nevertheless with golden parachutes and enormous salaries. And so there is some limitation on the ability during this rescue plan, during the period that companies are getting financial aid from the government, to reward their executives with new golden parachutes, new contracts that say, for example, when you leave, when you're forced out by the board of the company, or when you even leave voluntarily, you get $20 million or huge stock packages. There is additional authority and direction that the government should do something to try to help homeowners who are having trouble paying their mortgages, help them find a way to pay their mortgages, help them renegotiate the terms of their mortgages so that they won't lose their homes. It's not required that the Treasury Secretary do that, but the authority is there, and there's direction for the Secretary to do that.
So it sounds like there were some improvements, but unfortunately a lot of those improvements seem it's still up to the discretion of the Treasury Secretary whether they're actually going to utilize those improvements.
Yeah, and I think people expect that the Treasury Secretary will, and the other important thing that I forgot to mention is that the money is being divided into sort of sections or tranches, and the Secretary isn't allowed to rush out next week and spend all $700 billion. There's a timing of the money so that there will be a chance for Congress after the first half is spent to review and block the spending of the second $350 billion. But the important thing, I think, is that Congress, the situation was so dire that Congress couldn't put so much restraint on the Treasury Secretary that either the bill was delayed or that the Treasury Secretary is delayed in putting this into process, into practice. It has to be implemented. They have to begin, but nobody expects, or I think most people don't expect, all of this money to be spent quickly. The process might not even really begin in earnest until November, and so however you feel about Henry Paulson, the current secretary in the Bush administration, there's the hope that an Obama administration, for example, or even a McCain administration, will have somebody who will be more responsible than the current administration has been, and someone who people will feel better about relying on than Henry Paulson, who clearly has been part of the problem. He may be part of the solution now and a huge part, but he clearly was part of the problem coming into this.
Now, there are clearly things that didn't make it into the bill that you would have recommended, that you would have liked to have seen in the bill. What didn't get in there?
Well, the bankruptcy changes that I think are really a no-brainer, that the mortgage banking industry have resisted relentlessly, which say that if I'm a homeowner and I'm having trouble, I'm probably can't meet my mortgage, I'm in danger of foreclosure, and I'm in bankruptcy, I've declared bankruptcy, I can have the court, the bankruptcy court, include the mortgage and the debt and the repayment of that debt in the bankruptcy proceeding, so that when they reorganize all of my obligations and give me a workout schedule, it includes the mortgage and it includes the possibility of renegotiating it, what's called cramming down the mortgage and forcing the bank to accept less money, a smaller principal and a smaller monthly payment than they had originally negotiated. That is clearly the most effective way to save the millions of people, you know, as many as 6 million people who could be have their homes foreclosed in the next 12 months, and the administration fought that, the banking industry fought that, and from my point of view, why Congress would listen to the mortgage banking industry that is as responsible as any part of the American society for getting us into the mess we're in, why they would listen to them, I don't understand.
You indicated already that basically this bill had to pass if we were going to deal with the crisis. My sense is that your position and the position of EPI is that they had to pass something, that there is an urgency here. So what, you know, how is this bill going to change the scenario now? Is this really going to help turn things around, or what do you think needs to happen from here?
Well, the context is that the economy was already in recession. We've lost about 1 million jobs since last September in the last 12 months and 750,000 jobs since January. We have huge national problems, you know, this trade deficit of $700 billion. We have wages that are flat or actually have declined for most Americans, certainly for the average American since 2000, their wages are not keeping up with prices. The whole economy is grinding down. And to add on top of that, this credit crisis, which was already starting to cause companies to put off purchases, put off investments because they couldn't borrow money, lay off workers, it was just going to lead to a cascade that would be so dangerous. It's hard to imagine how bad it could have been. So this intervention is not going to, it's not a silver bullet. It's not going to end the recession. It's not going to put everyone who's lost their job in the last year back to work. It probably will not prevent us from losing as many as another million jobs over the last, over the next 9 to 12 months. But we are in a serious downward slide in the economy. But if we hadn't done this, it would be ever so much worse.
What does this mean for working class people in particular? I mean, I'm thinking here also about the fact that, you know, obviously concerns about health care, the desire to pass a universal health care plan finally is, I think, a top of the agenda for most working class people, the needs to invest in infrastructure, the concern about living wage jobs. Does this bailout plan now make it, you know, even more difficult to actually get things like universal health care?
It does, partly because of a perception that we've now increased the national debt by $700 billion, which isn't true. The money is authorized to be spent on these purposes, but the idea of it is that eventually these assets that are bought will be resold. So in the worst case scenario, if the government just buys the toxic assets, these collateralized debt obligations that include shaky mortgages and are worth, let's say, 75% of their face value, still, they'll be sold for that 75%, and the government will make that money back. So it's hard to imagine a scenario, even the worst-case scenario, where all of this money is spent. On the upside, it's possible that this will be done in a way where the companies stock is purchased by the government, the companies recover, they eventually make profits, and the government profits from it the way it did from the Chrysler bankruptcy and bailout and from the Lockheed bailout years ago. So keeping all of that in mind, there's no reason for this bailout to keep the next president from dealing with health care, from making major investments in infrastructure. In fact, there's all the more reason. The economy is in so much trouble that something has to be done, and something big, to stimulate the economy, to put people back to work, and to prevent the downward spiral that we're in now from worsening.
I guess, you know, there's a way to flip that question around, I guess, right, which is to say that if what got us in this crisis to begin with was the whole kind of deregulation, privatization mantra, the whole neoliberal kind of economic model that we've been living under for the last 30 years, then perhaps this bailout really is an argument for overturning that whole approach and for taking serious the need to invest in our economy, in infrastructure, in healthcare, in these things that will help stimulate the economy down the road.
That's absolutely right. And it also, as you say, it should lead everybody to reexamine the assumption that the unfettered market is the best route to economic security and prosperity. It clearly isn't. It's been a complete and total disaster. So people should then look. And these are some of the things that were left out of the bailout package. They should look at reforms. What are the reforms that are needed to provide transparency so that people know what the financial health is of institutions that they're dealing with, that are they're lending money to or investing in? How do we raise the money for the things that we need? That's been left out of this. Here we're authorizing $700 billion of spending, but there was no new tax included in this to pay for any part of the bailout. There will be some cost in all likelihood, and yet there's nothing to pay for it. A transaction tax on trading would be a good way to do this. Increases in taxes on the very wealthy, the people who have benefited over the last 10 to 20 years from this financial, this casino economy on Wall Street. Those people should be contributing much more to our national revenues to make it possible to invest in things like infrastructure. And
In fact, in referring to taxes, my understanding, too, is that part of the reason that this second bill passed is because it did include actually tax cuts, which is what some of the Republicans were pushing for.
It's true. The appetite in Congress to pass tax cuts is almost insatiable. It's the easy answer they have for every economic problem. And then, of course, the problem is the government then doesn't have the revenues that it needs to deal with issues like health care for children, which, expanding the SCHIP program to make sure that all children in America had health insurance coverage was considered too expensive. The government didn't have the revenue for it. Our infrastructure is crumbling. It's a mess. Everyone knows about bridges that are collapsing and highways with craters in them and levees that are not standing up to storms. The whole works. All of that needs an infusion of federal money, which can only come from tax revenues. So when Congress does this, another $100 billion or $150 billion of tax cuts on top of the bailout, you have to wonder, what are they thinking?
I know on our program, we've talked about this last week, certainly in the program. I know we've heard a lot already about what led up to this crisis, but I think it's important just to go back maybe for a minute again and remind our listeners once more, what are the key things that led us into this crisis to begin with?
Well, the most obvious thing, looking back, because it's the trigger that everyone could see, was the insane run-up in housing prices. And the way that happened, one of the ways that happened, was through lending practices that made it easy for people to buy houses that they couldn't afford. How is it that the mortgage lending industry got to the place where liars' loans, where people not only didn't put any money down, but they got money from the bank for writing a mortgage? I mean, these were insane practices that now have millions of people on the verge of foreclosure. The way that happened was through the financialization of mortgages, that mortgage brokers could write these deals knowing that they would never be paid back, that the homeowner had a very small chance of ever being able to meet the terms of the mortgage. But it didn't matter to the person who wrote the note, and the bank would sell the mortgage to Wall Street. Wall Street would break it up into pieces and sell it all around the world, and there was no accountability. That's the first problem is that failure of accountability, and then a culture of corruption, and that we saw in Enron. It's pervasive in Wall Street, where people were hiding from everyone else what their true liabilities were. There's a practice of putting liabilities, of having enormous liabilities that are not reflected on balance sheets. That when someone is lending money now to a corporation or to a bank, another financial institution, they don't know whether that bank can pay it back. They can't trust that the financial statements are honest anymore. Then there's the problem, which I read this week, that Hank Paulson was personally responsible for. The Secretary of Treasury, when he was at Goldman Sachs, went to the Securities and Exchange Commission and asked them to relax the rules on what the reserve assets that had to be held by the giant banks were, so that instead of having $10 of obligations for every dollar that they had in reserve, they would have $30 of obligations for every dollar of assets they had. So then when there's a problem and someone doesn't pay them back, they can't pay the people that they owe. And there's a chain reaction, and these huge banks like Lehman Brothers come down in a matter of days and then threaten the entire financial structure. So we've had years and years of deregulation, of very lax accounting standards. The other problem that I haven't mentioned is the credit rating agencies that would take these loans, these very poor loans, and package them together in bundles, and they'd be sold on Wall Street by Wall Street brokerage houses, and they'd get a rating from the credit agencies, and the agencies were paid by, for example, Merrill Lynch to rate the securities. So there's a conflict of interest there, and they would rate them AAA and sell them all around the world. And then people would discover subsequently that what they'd bought was not AAA. And that kind of practice just destroys trust. It makes it impossible for the credit industry to work properly because people don't know the value of what they're buying.
Yeah, it seems to me that key to any prevention in the future of this happening again is going to be a whole new regulatory structure. I mean, I think we need to go back, you know, prior to some of the changes that were made to Glass-Steagall and other aspects that regulated the financial services industry. There was, you know, I think it was in 1999 that they passed that repeal of much of the what had regulated the financial services industry since the New Deal. Is that one of the major priorities that you'd see going out from the future here?
Yes, re-regulation, finding a way to limit the amount of leverage that these giant institutions have, to provide for much greater transparency, to put a stop to the conflicts of interest that contributed so much to these problems, finding a way to prevent. In other parts of the world, it's illegal to to lend money to somebody when you know that they can't repay it. You know, we don't have that law. I mean, you would think it was unethical, and that it's a practice that hardly makes sense. Yet it was done all over America aggressively by mortgage bankers, and we need a rule to prevent that. There's a lot that needs to be done to clean up this industry.
And on the broader issue of an economic reconstruction plan, you know, I've actually even heard some mainstream news commentators now refer to this as perhaps the period of the New Deal. I mean, that's something I can't imagine having heard, you know, a few months back. But now they're talking about the need for a New Deal. What would be the number one priorities or the list of priorities that you'd have in an economic reconstruction plan?
Well, the kinds of financial reforms that I just mentioned would be very important. The New Deal, when you think back, what was it? One of the centerpieces was putting people back to work. We have $1.6 trillion of infrastructure repairs and maintenance that haven't been done. It's a giant problem, and it's going to require a massive investment by the federal government on the same scale as what the New Deal did. I think it's not out of the question to say that we need to be putting about $300 billion into putting people to work, rebuilding schools, roads, bridges, doing sewage treatment plants, investing in mass transit, and then making the kinds of investments that we need to deal with the two biggest problems facing the Main Street economy beyond this financial crisis, which are energy and our trade deficit, that we need to create an industry in the United States that the federal government is going to have to lead the way to create an alternative energy industry and that frees us from having to buy foreign oil. If we could buy an alternative energy industry and through the use of the creation of an electric car industry so that automobiles ran without fossil fuels, we could cut our trade deficit in half, free ourselves from dependence on foreign oil, and really make a difference on climate change and the environment. So, you know, that I think is at the very heart of what a New Deal would be.
Well, Ross, thanks for taking out time to talk to me about this. I mean, this is you know, an issue that we're going to be living with for probably the rest of this generation. So it's something that we're going to keep coming back to, and I definitely look forward to having you back on the program in the future to see how this all unfolds.
Okay, I'm sorry to say I think you're right, and thanks for having me.
And that was Ross Eisenbray of the Economic Policy Institute talking about the financial crisis. This is an issue that we're going to be dealing with for many, many years to come. And so we're going to continue to deal with it here on Labor Express. On next week's program, we're going to hear from some more economists. And the ones that we're going to hear from on next week's program are, I think, take a bit dimmer view of the bailout plan. I think they feel that the bailout package that passed was so not what we need, that it actually may hurt us in the long run. And so we're going to hear from them on next week's program, a slightly different take, although both groups agree that something has to happen. And of course, the Economic Policy Institute wasn't thrilled about what passed, but they feel like there was an urgency here that something had to be passed. You can find out more about the Economic Policy Institute by going to their website, which is epi.org. There's a link to their website on my blog as well as on the Labor Express website. Definitely encourage you to check out the Labor Express website, because right on the homepage of the Labor Express website is the link to my blog, pilsenproly.blogspot.com. And one of the first entries up there right now has a lot more information and resources about the financial crisis. So you want more details about, you know, what's going on, links to organizations that are dealing with this issue, various statements by various economists about what's going on, as well as audio from last week's program, where we had a terrific program, I thought, about, you know, talking to a number of people about what this crisis is all about. Go to my blog, and the easiest way to get there is to go to laborexpress.org, and in the middle of the homepage at laborexpress.org is a link to my blog, which is pilsenproly.blogspot.com. Click on that, and it'll either, I think it's the second entry right now, there's another one I just added tonight, but the second entry has got a whole bunch of information about the financial crisis, so you definitely want to take a look at that and turn in again next week for much more on this situation. That's all for tonight's program. Labor Express is a nonprofit affiliate with IBEW Local 1220. The views expressed on Labor Express are those of its producers and not those of IBEW. Labor Express is a production of the Committee for Labor Access in Chicago, the world capital of the labor movement. The song we use as our theme song is called The Worker Song and was written by Ed Pickford and recorded by the Dropkick Murphys. Tune in again next week at 7 p.m. for another edition of Labor Express.